Genesis 37 to Genesis 50. And there's several spots in the story I just cried, as the players in the story cried, because it just blew me away, that story, just how dark human beings can be in light of the fall, the tragedy and the pain and the sorrow that was happening in the context. But in the whole story, God's still weaving this redemptive reality in his purposes in persons' lives, which is amazing. And I think that that's how a lot about a weekend like Lazarus Weekend is, that we do come, all of us have come. I have in my own life had to experience a lot of healing from things as a result of just this fallen world and relationships with fallen people. And yet the whole time, God's also weaving his eternal purposes and destiny in my life as part of the whole thing. And that we do live in a fallen world. We live, Song of Solomon talks about the wilderness of this fallen world. And yet Song of Solomon says that Jesus has come as a victorious warrior to bring us into to carry us through this fallen world safely and victoriously. So there's still the stuff, there's still the desert, the wilderness, the things that happen, but at the same time, he wins. And I think that's one. I love the song that Luke did, because our only issue is that our own surrendered heart and the fact that you're here, that you want to be clean before him. You just want to be healed up as much as you can be, because you don't want anything in your life to hinder or restrict what God can do. You need to understand, the enemy is not an equal with God. And the fact that Jesus rose from the dead and the way it happened, it just screams at us that that God wins. But we get to experience that reality as we participate and cooperate with him. That's why I kept saying to you last night, just cooperate. Just be transparent. Just go for it. Risk it. Because God has a redemptive story and purpose in your life. It says in Revelation chapter 1, that he is and he was and he is and he is to come. And all of us were, as we became Christians, we were placed into his story. And your life is now his story. And he's able, he bought and purchased your, redeemed your past and your present his story. Your past is now not the devil's story. It's not your story, it's his story. He redeemed all that. Your future is not your story or the devil's story, it's his story. And your present is not your story, the devil's story, it's his story. We have to kind of get in that flow and understand that. And so this story, this I love this this place in Genesis, because it has so full of human brokenness and yet so full of the promises of God and prophetic dreams of God's put in your life of what you're called to do and be, and to see how God brings that to pass in spite of the enemy's best effort and broken, fallen peoples just messing things up. So, Father, I just thank you for our time together this morning. Lord, just anoint the things that are said. Give us ears to hear. Lord, I just pray that you would use the teaching just to loosen some things, to oil some things that need to be broken off of us, things that have been tight, that are tight and rusty because they've been there a long time. Lord, just release and free us. Add spiritual words to spiritual thoughts in Jesus' name. Amen. So what we're going to kind of address this first session is about the issue of forgiveness and the sovereignty of God. And I don't understand all this. I've listened to really only Americans and Europeans try to figure it all out and explain it, create these theologies, and they don't understand it either. It just bothers them that they don't understand it, so they have to come up with something. I don't understand free will and sovereignty and how they work. I know they're true. We have free will, and yet I know that God is sovereign and has declared the end from the beginning. Now, how does that fit? I don't have a clue. It doesn't have to fit. God's bigger than I am. His ways aren't my ways. His ways are higher. And his ways, the scripture says, are unsearchable. And so some of the things that we're going to share, I can't figure them out. And if you ask me questions about it, I probably don't have an answer. I've gotten older and feel comfortable with that. And I like slipping into my second childhood, because that's necessary if you're going to enter in. If you're going to explore the kingdom, you've got to become like a little child. And little children don't have to understand everything. They just believe what you tell them. And I remember when the kids were growing up, we would travel, and you know, you hit these sections, especially in Alabama and rural South, where you have just a lot of, there's nothing, just pine trees. And they were always asking, you know, where are we at now, Daddy? Where are we at now, Daddy? So I would just, we'd get to those places, I'd go, it's Treeville. And of course, and then finally one day after several years, my oldest son, Woody, said, Dad, Treeville's really big, isn't it? Because it's everywhere. I said, yeah, it really is big. They're just naive. I like lying to them a lot when they were little, making them believe stupid things. Genesis 37. Now Jacob lived in the land where his father had sojourned, in the land of Canaan. And these are the records of the generations of Jacob. Joseph, when 17 years of age, was pasturing the flock with his brothers while he was still a youth, along with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. Joseph brought back a bad report about them to their father. And now Israel loved Joseph more than all of his sons, because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a very colored tunic, which represented the inheritance. His brothers saw that their father loved him more than all of his brothers, and so they hated him and could not speak to him on friendly terms. And then Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. And he said to them, please listen to this dream which I have had. For behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and lo, my sheaf rose up and also stood erect. And behold, your sheaves gathered around and bowed down to my sheaf. And then his brother said to him, are you actually going to reign over us? Or are you really going to rule over us? And so they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. Now he had another dream, and related it to his brothers, and said, lo, I've had still another dream. Behold, the sun and the moon and the 11 stars were bowing down to me. And he related it to his father and to his brothers, and his father rebuked him and said to him, what is this dream that you've had? Shall I and your mother and your brothers actually come to bow ourselves down before you to the ground? And his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the saying in mind. Now let me give you a little bit of a background. And this is all maybe really familiar to you, but just a reminder of background about Joseph's life. And some of you may have come from a really dysfunctional family, but Joseph's dysfunctional family is kind of one for the ages. So let me just remind you a little bit about his circumstances that he was born into. Joseph's father, of course, was Jacob. The word Jacob means manipulator, maneuverer. God changed his name to Israel, though he's referred to here still as Jacob, and then sometimes as Israel. But he had spent most of his life lying and manipulating and maneuvering, trying to position himself into the place where God could do the things that he wanted God to do in his life. And it was unnecessary because God had already chosen him, but he did it anyway. And Jacob, when he went to work for his uncle, I'm going to leave out some parts, but it'll take too long for all the parts. He goes, he flees from his home, he's fleeing from his brother, he doesn't want to get killed by Esau because he cheated and lied to Esau out of his birthright. And so he's gone to his uncle's house to live, and when he goes to his uncle's house, he sees his daughter named Rachel, and he falls in love with her immediately. And he asks Laban for Rachel's hand in marriage. And Laban says, well, if you'll work 7 years for me, at the end of the 7 years, you can have Rachel as your wife. Now, Rachel had a sister, a big sister, named Leah. But it was Rachel that Jacob was in love with. So Jacob works for 7 years. And on the wedding night, evidently for whatever reason, I don't know, but Leah never evidently could get married. They had a hard time finding a husband that would marry her or whatever. It may have been her winning personality or great good looks. I don't know what the problem was, but she wasn't married. And she was the oldest. And so her father, Laban, was concerned about that. He wanted her to get married. And now the younger daughter is going to get married. So the night of the wedding, when Jacob's going to marry Rachel, the younger sister that he was in love with, he got so drunk at the party that when he went into his tent, Laban sent Leah, the older sister that he couldn't marry off, and he went into her and consummated marriage with the wrong sister. And when he woke up the next day, he realized he had married the wrong sister and went out and talked to Laban and said, you've done me wrong. I was supposed to marry your daughter, Rachel. He said, well, you perform your bridal week with Leah, and at the end of the bridal week, you can marry Rachel too. You can have them both. But then you got to work for me for 7 more years. So Jacob did that. And earlier it said those first 7 years, that those 7 years seemed but a few days because he loved Rachel so much. So he marries the wrong sister. Now, I didn't have an always walk with the Lord. And so I knew what it was like to be intoxicated. But I've never been so intoxicated that I would have married the wrong sister. So he wasn't just little intoxicated. He was hammered. All righty? That's a good story to tell about your dad. And so he marries. Now he's married to two of them. Go back in Genesis. You have to trust me. This is a story. But he loved Rachel. There's even one place where it says that he hated Leah. But Leah loved him. Of course, Rachel loved him. And so what Leah began to do is begin to have children. But Rachel, the one who Jacob loved, was barren. And immediately Leah, the one he doesn't love, and having children, especially to a Jew back in those days, was a big deal. And so Leah immediately has four sons. And she keeps saying and naming the sons in such a way, it's like, he'll love me now. Now he'll love me. Now I'll be his favorite. And then Rachel's getting real jealous because she's afraid that might be true. And she knows the whole marriage thing with Leah was a cheap thing anyway. Leah was in on it, you know, with her dad. And so there was all that bitterness there she had towards her sister. And then Leah was bitter towards Rachel because she was married to a guy she loved but didn't love her and was wanted to be with Rachel. You know, it's just a mess. But Leah's having children. She has four sons in a row. And Rachel has to watch this happen. And so it's making Rachel more jealous and hating Leah even more. And Leah's having kids, but Jacob's not loving her anymore, so she's hating Rachel even more. And so what Rachel does is decides, since she can't have children, she has a handmaid that her father had given her named Bilhah. And she decided what she would do is that she would give Bilhah to Jacob and as one of his wives, and Jacob would go into her and have, maybe they would have children. They would represent her children. And of course, Jacob, being the godly man that he was, decided that was the Lord. And so he went in, and now he has a third wife. And Bilhah has a couple of children, two sons. And now Leah's not having any kids, and so she's not really happy. And so she decides the things that she'll do. She'll take her handmaid named Zilpah, and she'll give him to Jacob to compete for these children. And it literally says, and she became his wives. And Jacob, being the studious, godly, prayerful man that he was, decided that was a good idea too. And so he goes in to Bilhah, and she has two boys. And so now the score is that, is in terms of Leah's side, is six and Rachel two. And then Leah has a couple more. And then finally at the end, Rachel, God opens up her womb. She has two kids. The first one's named Joseph. So he's the firstborn of the wife that Jacob really loved. And then she had, the last one was named Benjamin. Now she died when Benjamin, like at his birth, and she named him Benoah, son of my sorrows. But Jacob named him Benjamin, son of my right hand. But it's the fact that Rachel named him son of my sorrow. She died in bitterness. Because even though Jacob loved her, she had to watch this whole thing play out and be married to, there were four of them now, but being married to his sister. And as a matter of fact, there was one point, you think, well, Rachel, she's like, I feel sorry for both of them. But at one point, Rachel saw Reuben, which was one of Leah's sons, carrying some mandrakes. And Rachel said, can I have some of those mandrakes? And Leah goes, well, you already stole my husband. Well, she's the one who stole the husband. You stole my husband, now you want my son's mandrakes. And Rachel said this, I tell you what, if you'll give me the mandrakes, I'll make Jacob sleep with you tonight. Because he didn't like to do that as much, I don't guess. He was too busy with all the other three. Plus, he wanted to really be with Rachel. And so you think, Rachel, you did what? For some fruit? So it was just a weird deal. And they're all hating each other. And then as I read to you, the story of Joseph was loved the most and was given the very colored tunic by Jacob because one, he was the son of his old age and he was Rachel's firstborn, which is one they love. So now here's the household. You with me? This is the Thanksgiving dinner scene. You got the two sisters who hate each other. You got brothers and who hate each other, and then you got half brothers with, and you got handmaids who, they're called wives, but I imagine they felt pretty inferior. The war is really going on between Rachel and Leah, and yet you have just a crazy, crazy situation. And they had one daughter. We had one sister. Her name was Dinah. She got raped by a person, and so all the brothers, being the godly people they were, they went to the city and just and killed the whole city, wiped everybody out, wiped all the men off. Had them all get circumcised so they would become Jews, talked them into it while they were recovering from circumcision, killed them all. So they're murderers, one of them was raped, you got the whole brothers and stuff hating each other. And here's the thing you need to understand, none of that was Joseph's fault. It wasn't his fault that his father slept with the wrong woman and married the wrong woman at the wedding. It wasn't his fault that Rachel, his mother, couldn't give as many children. It wasn't his fault that Jacob went into Zilpah and Bilhah. It wasn't his fault that he had all this sibling rival and hatred. None of that stuff was his fault. He was born into those situations. That doesn't seem very fair. Not his fault. Wasn't his fault his sister got raped and there was all that. Wasn't his fault that his brothers were murderers. They wiped out a whole village or a whole city, a whole town. That wasn't his fault either. None of that stuff was his fault. It wasn't his fault that his father loved him the most. It wasn't his fault. He was born, the firstborn, to the woman that Jacob really loved. And therefore, it wasn't his fault that his father gave him the very color tunic. That wasn't his fault. Now, people will talk about the story of Joseph and how his amazing story, he's a type of Christ, because you never see him sin. I don't believe that at all. It wasn't like news to Joseph that his brothers hated him. He grew up in that environment. It wasn't news to him. They didn't like the fact that Joseph loved him the most. It says they knew about it and hated him. And one of the scriptures says they never had anything nice to say to him. It wasn't his fault he got the very color. I mean, it wasn't, you know, he got this very color tunic, all that kind of stuff. And he knew they hated him. When he shared the dreams, it said they hated him even more. And then he shared the second dream, and they hated him even more. His father rebuked him for the second dream. So it wasn't like he didn't know. So I don't think that when he shared with them the two dreams that they'd bow down to him and honor him came out of a good place in his heart. That's an important part of the story because some of the mess that he ends up in is not his fault. Most of it's not his fault. But he did make some choices that added to the mess. You see, we're going to be talking about redemption and our ability to forgive and commitment to forgive in light of redemption. Because you see, redemption doesn't just forgive. Redemption overrules for good and restores all the loss occasioned by sin. Either the sin against me, the sin of others, the activity of the devil, or my own sin. Because we usually add to our bad story by our own behavior, right? And so I believe Joseph blew it pretty bad. And people who already hate you and are jealous, and so they want to hear is that you're going to bow down to them, and they're going to bow down to you and basically worship you. So there comes a place when he's 17 years old. His brothers all go off to a place to pasture some of the flock. Jacob was a wealthy man. And his father says to Joseph, Joseph, go check them out. Go see how they're doing. Because, you know, early on it says they were pasturing, and Joseph came back and gave a bad report. Well, I do not think that was really good either. Just what you want is a rat in the family. If you ever had more than one kid in the family, there's always one that's ratting out the other one all the time. And you kind of tell them, look, I said, stop ratting out your brother. You're ratting out your sister. You know, at some point, stop it. And so I think probably Jacob was concerned that they weren't doing right again, weren't doing a very good job of taking care of things. So he has the son to go check him out. And he wears the very colored tunic to go check him out. I'm sure he had another coat. He had to have something else, right? I don't think that's the only thing he wore. And in light of how they felt, I don't think I'd have worn that thing. So he goes to find them. And when he goes to find them, they're not where he thought they were going to be. But a man meets him, sees him wandering around, says, what are you looking for? He says, well, I'm looking for my brothers, pasturing the flock. He says, oh, they've gone. They're now in Dothan. Not Alabama, but Dothan, Israel. And so he goes, And their brothers see him coming from a distance. And they looked and said, here comes that dreamer. And they had really high thoughts of him. As they see him, they said, when they saw him from a distance, before he came close, they plotted against him to put him to death. And they said to one another, here comes this dreamer. Now then, come, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. And we will say, a wild beast devoured him. Then let us see what will become of his dreams then. Just a little bitterness. But Reuben, one of Leah's, I think it's Leah's first. Reuben, there's some nobility here. But Reuben heard this and rescued him out of their hands and said, let us not take his life. Reuben further said to them, shed no blood. Throw him into this pit that is in the wilderness, but do not lay hands on him. And he said this, that he, Reuben, might rescue him out of their hands to restore him to his father. Whew. God's got somebody there that's going to make this thing work out better. Reuben says, let's talk somebody to kill him, throw him in the pit. And his whole plan all along was at some point when they weren't looking or they had gone, he was going to go back and get him and take him back to his father, save his life. So God had somebody there that could bail Joseph out of this situation. So it came about when Joseph reached his brothers that they stripped Joseph of his tunic and his the very colored tunic that was on him. Like I said, he should have worn something else. And they took him and threw him into the pit. And now the pit was empty without any water in it. And they sat down to eat a meal. Let me just show you something about just humanity. This is chapter 42. Verse 21, it says, then they said to one another, the brothers, this is when they first were getting in trouble in Egypt. They said to one another, truly we are guilty concerning our brother, because we saw the distress of his soul when he pleaded with us, yet we would not listen. Therefore, this distress has come upon us. It wasn't like Joseph was lying there in the pit and decided to take a nap. He was distressed and he was pleading with them, begging them to deliver him out of the pit. And they sat down and had a meal while their brother was pleading for deliverance. That's what I mean. When you think of Joseph's family, I mean, how messed up can humanity get? You know, the rivals, his father's behavior, the whole four wives thing, the hatred among each other. I mean, his mother, his stepmother was also his aunt. And I mean, that whole thing's crazy. And they hated each other. He lived in that house every day growing up for 17 years. Just hatred and bitterness and jealousy. Then the rape, the murder thing. And now here are his brothers who are so cruel that they throw him in a pit and they sit down to have a meal while their brother's pleading for his life and pleading to be rescued. That's pretty awful. As they sat down to eat a meal and they raised their eyes and looked, behold, a caravan of Ishmaelites was coming from Gilead, with their camels bearing aromatic gum and balm and myrrh, on their way to bring them down to Egypt. And Judah said to his brothers, what profit is us for us to kill our brother and cover up his blood? Even though they hadn't killed him yet, because Reuben, they were still thinking we're going to kill him. And Judah said to his brothers, and then says, come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him, for he is our brother, our own flesh. Oh, bless your heart. You're not going to kill him. He's your brother. We're not going to kill him. We're just going to sell him into slavery. That's awful. And his brothers listened to him. And then some Midianite traders came by, so they pulled him up and lifted Joseph out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. Thus they brought, these traders brought Joseph into Egypt. Now Reuben returned to the pit, because he's going to rescue him, right? And Joseph was not in the pit, so he tore his garments. And he returned to his brothers and said, the boy is not there. As for me, where am I to go? And they took Joseph's tunic, slaughtered a male goat, dipped the tunic in the blood. And they sent the very colored tunic and brought it to their father and said, we found this. Please examine it to see whether it's your son's tunic or not. And then he examined it and he said, it is my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to pieces. So Jacob tore his clothes, put sackcloth on his loins, and mourned for his son many days. Then all of his sons and all of his daughters rose to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted, and said, "Surely I will go down to Sheol in mourning for my son." So his father wept for him. Meanwhile, the Midianites sold him into Egypt to Potiphar, Pharaoh's officer, the captain of Pharaoh's bodyguard. This is so awful that not only what Joseph went through, pleading for his life, now sold as a 17-year-old into slavery, but they go back and tell their father a lie, and his father is so grieving over this son, this firstborn of Rachel, he said, "I will go down to Sheol mourning for my son." And he lived with that for 13 years. And as you read the story in the rest of those chapters, he never gets past that. He always was referring to the fact that, "And I lost my oldest son." It really wasn't his oldest son, but he was the oldest of Rachel. And he never got past that. And they let him live with that all those years. I mean, just again, broken, fallen, cruel, deceived, evil humanity. Now, for Joseph's story, what happens, it continues, and you don't have to turn there, but in chapter 39, it begins to tell the story of Joseph being in Potiphar's household. Now, Potiphar, again, is real connected to Pharaoh because he's the captain of his bodyguard. So those people who were with him, with Pharaoh all the time, and he was like the Secret Service. He's like the head of the Secret Service who protect the president. And so he's there working for Potiphar, and things are going as well as they can as a slave. Potiphar's wife begins to take a liking for him. And so she asks him to come and lie with her, and he goes, "Well, no, I'm not going to do that," because he said, "My master has given everything into my hands, and why would I do that?" And as a matter of fact, I'll just read this part too, it's kind of cool. Says, having been given to Potiphar, this is chapter 39, verse 2, "And the Lord was with Joseph, and he became a successful man and was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. And his master saw that the Lord was with him." You know that you can see when God's with somebody? When God's favor, when God's presence is on somebody, you can see it. "Now his master saw the Lord was with him and how the Lord caused all that he did to prosper in his hand. So Joseph found favor in his sight and became his personal servant, and he made him overseer over his house and all that he owned. He put Joseph in charge." Now that's really awesome, but now he's still a slave. He can't just live his life. But in that situation, God's presence was his, God's favor was on him, and God prospered him, gave him a lot of leverage in that environment situation. When Potiphar's wife begins to hit on him, says in verse 9, "There is no one in this house," Joseph is answering Potiphar's wife, no one greater in this house than I. And he, Potiphar, withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How then could I do this great evil and sin against God?" Man, what a righteous stand, right? And so he's doing the right thing. He said the right thing. He's resisting. But every day she's hitting on him. More and more. And then finally one day he came in and she grabbed his garment once again to to molest him, and he ran, the garment came off, and so he ran out of the house. And here she is with his garment in her hands. She decides the only thing she can do to save her own reputation, she begins to scream, and others come in the house, and she said he tried to rape her and fled. And so they believed that story. When Potiphar got home, he believed the story and got really angry. I don't know why he believed the story, because I don't think this was her first rodeo. But maybe it was important to him to believe that story. And it says in verse 19 of 39, "Now it came about when his master heard the words of his wife, which she spoke to him, saying, 'This is what the slave did to me.' Then Potiphar's anger burned. So Joseph's master took him and put him into the jail, the place where the king's prisoners were." So these were the high-ranking prisoners, like people who were caught in sedition and wanting to overthrow the king or Pharaoh and all that kind of stuff. And he was there in jail, and personal people that Pharaoh himself put in jail. But the Lord, here we go again, but the Lord was with Joseph, just like it said in chapter 39, verse 2 at Potiphar's, "and extended kindness to him and gave him favor in the sight of the chief jailer. And the chief jailer committed to Joseph's charge all the prisoners who were in the jail, so that whatever was done there, he was responsible for it. The chief jailer did not supervise anything under Joseph's charge because the Lord was with him. And whatever he did, the Lord made him to prosper. Now the next scene is he's in this jail. And he's in this jail and he's in charge of all the stuff. Now he's still a prisoner, but he's got a lot of freedom. He's in charge of everything. And Pharaoh gets mad for some reason at his cupbearer and his baker, personal cupbearer and baker, and throws them into that jail. And Joseph meets them and gets to know them. And then they have this dream. And both of them have this dream on the same night. And they ask Joseph something about this dream. Joseph noticed they looked troubled. They said they had a dream. And Joseph basically said, well, God's the interpreter of dreams. And if I was Joseph, I'd be like going, I don't care if you had a dream. I had a dream a couple of times, and it didn't turn out well for me. I don't want anything to do with dreams. But he does, interprets their dream, and basically tells them that within 3 days, the cupbearer would be restored to Pharaoh's charge, but the poor baker's head was going to be cut off. I mean, I don't know what he did, but whatever it was, the chocolate chip cookies, Dan, were not very good, evidently. A bad batch of chocolate chip cookies, that's right. That would require death, right? And we're going to have to assign somebody to Dan when they can let us eat the cookies, because those chocolate chip cookies are going to be going down. Dan has a little miniature conveyor belt he has in his backseat of his car, and he just opens his mouth, turns the conveyor belt, and cookies just go in his mouth. In search, always, of the best chocolate chip cookie. But here's the thing, is that when he gives them this dream, and he looks to the cupbearer, who got the favorable interpretation that your life's going to be spared, he says in verse 14 of chapter 40, only keep me in mind when it goes well with you, and please do me a kindness by mentioning me to Pharaoh and get me out of this house. For I was in fact kidnapped from the land of the Hebrews, and even here I've done nothing that they should have put me into this dungeon. The last part of chapter 40, the cupbearer is restored, life is given him and Pharaoh, and it says in verse 23, yet the chief cupbearer did not remember Joseph, but forgot him. What? How could that? I mean, if somebody interpreted my dream and resulted in my life getting saved, I mean, my memory's not that great, but I think I would remember, don't you? But no. Well, you know, it wasn't Joseph's fault that he ended up being sold as a slave, was it? I mean, he didn't help the situation, but that wasn't an excuse for his brothers to throw him into a pit, right? Wasn't his fault that these Ishmaelites, traitors, come along at just the right time and he got sold into slavery? It wasn't his fault. He had some fault, the pride, the tunic, the dreams, all that nonsense, which contributed to the mess. But all these other things were things that weren't his fault. Then ended up with Potiphar. That wasn't his choice. He just got sold. He got bought by Potiphar. And it wasn't his fault that Potiphar's wife started hitting on him, had some issues in her life. And then it wasn't his fault that they went that day and she pulled on his thing and he ran off without his clothes on and she decided to lie about him and told everybody he tried to rape her. That wasn't his fault. And it wasn't his fault that Potiphar believed her, which he shouldn't have. Joseph had proven himself more faithful than her, but it wasn't his fault. And it wasn't his fault he got thrown in this particular jail. That wasn't his fault. He was in prison. He had done nothing wrong. He said, I'm not going to sin against you, my master and God. So because he didn't sin, he ended up in prison. And it wasn't his, you know, and so he wasn't in control of the cupbearer and the baker that they messed up at the time they did. They ended up in the jail with him. And it wasn't his fault they had a dream. And he gave them the interpretation of the dream. And the one who had the favorable dream, it wasn't his fault that he forgot for 2 years. I mean, life's just kind of happening to him. And it's going downhill from the pit to the slave to a prisoner. And I would assume that if he had stayed in prison, he was going to pretty much die. If you get hung for making bad chocolate chip cookies, can you imagine, because Pharaoh and Potiphar were close, because he's the captain of the bodyguard, the head of the secret service, I'm sure if he would have said something to Pharaoh, see, I tried to rape my wife, and he had been hung too, right? But he just sits there for 2 years in prison. Now, Pharaoh has a dream. And he has this dream about 7 years this and 7 years that. And nobody in the land can interpret the dream. I guess we're all afraid to after what happened to the baker. You know, if I don't get this thing quite right. And so he has his dream, and finally, after 2 years, the cupbearer goes, "Oh yeah, dreams. I know a guy." And he told about his story. And so Pharaoh said, "Well, let's get the guy out of the prison." And Joseph interprets a dream and says, "What's going to happen is in the land of Egypt, we're going to have 7 years of plenty. Great harvest. It's going to be incredible. But after that, it's going to be 7 years of horrible famine." And so he said, "This is what I think I would do. I would gather up and store up a lot during the 7 years of plenty. And then during the 7 years of famine, everybody's going to want to come here to buy food. And Egypt's going to get really, really rich." And as a matter of fact, how it all ended up, everybody in Egypt lost all their land. They sold even their land to Joseph to buy food. And people from all over the world came, because there's a worldwide famine, that part of the world anyway, to come to buy food. And he was so stunned at the interpretation and so stunned at the wisdom, on the spot, he made Joseph second in charge of all of Egypt. As a matter of fact, he said, he gave him a signet ring, and he said, "Everything that you say to do, everybody in the land is going to have to do. Everybody's going to have to bow down to you." So he made him second in charge, more than a vice president, because he was so active. Pharaoh was almost a figurehead. Though he had authority, Joseph ran the country as if he was the head guy. Wow. So the dream did come true. The sheaves would bow down, the sun, the moon, the stars would bow down, because the dreams were all about him being in a position of authority, in a position of rule. Now, 13 years after he got the dream, he's 30 years old when this happens, and everything in between looked like it was going the wrong way, the dreams began to come true. So, what if his family had not been so dysfunctional? What if there hadn't been all this nonsense? What if in the midst of all of them, there was something special about him because he was Rachel's firstborn? And what if his father didn't love him more? And what if his father hadn't given him the varicolored tunic? Then his brothers wouldn't have hated him so. If he hadn't been born Rachel's first, his brothers wouldn't have hated him as much. What if they hadn't hated him so much? What if there weren't such yucky stuff going on, hatred and all the kind of things? Just the dysfunctional family lived in, the hatred. What if his father had not loved him the most, had not given the tunic? What if all that? What if he had not blown it and told him about the dreams? What if he had not strutted around all the time with a varicolored tunic? And what if, when they saw him, his father hadn't told him to go find his brothers? And what if, in doing that, they saw him and they go, "Here comes a dreamer"? And what if they had not thrown him in the pit? And what if these Midianite traitors had not come along just when they did? Because you see, if they hadn't come along when they did, Reuben would have rescued him. I mean, Reuben was ready. God had a backup plan. God had an out. This thing wasn't turning out really well. The dream wasn't happening. And God had every opportunity, because Reuben was set to do it, to rescue this kid. And he got snatched out of that. Oh, man, that's terrible. But what if the Midianite traders hadn't showed up? And it says this about the Midianite traders, because you see, obviously, the dream was fulfilled in Egypt about being in a position of real authority. And it says in verse 28 of chapter 37, "Thus they brought Joseph to Egypt." And what if he hadn't ended up with Potiphar? It had to be Potiphar, captain of the bodyguard. What if he had not ended up there and Potiphar didn't have this goofball wife? And what if she had not tried to take advantage of him every day? And what if she had not lied about him? What if Potiphar had chosen to believe Joseph and not her? What if he had not been thrown in that prison? And what if this cupbearer and baker who made bad cookies didn't get thrown in there? And what if they hadn't had that dream? And then what if he hadn't interpreted the dream? And what if the cupbearer had said something to to Pharaoh when he was supposed to? I don't think it would have meant that much to Pharaoh. Well, okay, the guy, look what he got. He had investigated and found out what he did. Hey, no, he tried to rape the captain of my bodyguard's wife. But 2 years later, when he has the dream, what if the cupbearer had remembered earlier? And what if Pharaoh 2 years later hadn't had a dream? And what if Then the cupbearer remembered, and what if he wasn't able to interpret the dream? And then his dream would have never been fulfilled. It's a remarkable thing to me. Nobody has the ability to rob you of God's destiny for you. If somebody walks out of your life, if somebody abandons you, if somebody rejects you, your story's not over. It's just their part in your story is over. And when these brothers passed Joseph on to these slave traders, at least for 13 years, their part in his story was done. And then the traitors took over. None of those things were his fault. And yet those traitors, those slave traitors, provided transportation. What if Reuben had rescued him and he'd have messed it all up? Did God put it in the heart of his brothers to want to kill him? Absolutely not. God can tempt no man to evil, it says in James. You hear what I'm saying to you? Did God want Jacob to get so drunk on his wedding night he married the wrong person? No. Did God want all this sibling thing? Did God want Jacob to be so excited about Zilpah and Bilhah? No. Did God want to have four wives? No. Did God want the daughter to get raped? No. Did he want brothers to be murderers? No. Were any of those things that what God would chose him? No. But are all those things so big? Is the devil's activity and fallen people so big that they have the ability to just frustrate God's purposes and plans in a person's life who wants God's will more than anything else in the world? Absolutely not. We've done this before here recently. Think about, so those of you who've heard this, bear with me, but just to tie this together, what about Joseph and Mary? A couple of kids, poor kids, who were called to steward this birth of the Messiah. But they needed to be in Bethlehem because Micah chapter 5 said that's where it's supposed to happen. But they're living up in Nazareth, which is like the other part of Israel. And so what's God going to do? How's this going to work out? How are they going to get down there? Somebody could send them an email, I guess, so you need to really be in Bethlehem. So what God did, he got an evil man named Caesar Augustus, who was a powerful Roman emperor, who was the first one to decide that emperors, that Caesars were gods and should be worshipped. And he built a huge statue of himself in Rome, but he wanted more statues all over his realm. And so he decided to take a census of all the Roman Empire, whether they were Romans or they were slaves, like Israelites were, and the Jews were and other nations were, and he decided to take a census of every person that was in his kingdom so he could take a tax to find out, one, how many worshipers he had, and to get money from them to build more statues and monuments and huge buildings that were committed to him along with the gods that they worship. It'd be like the big temple of Zeus and this temple of Caesar, that kind of stuff. All built one in Israel. And that's a horrible thing. That's not like a God thing, right? I don't think God wants that to happen. But he declares a census, and the way he's going to do the census is everybody's got to go back to their ancestral hometown. Well, the city of David is Bethlehem, and both of Joseph and Mary were part of David's offspring, and so she's pregnant, really pregnant, and just what you want to do when you're really pregnant is get on a donkey and drive, go over the desert and mountains and stuff and go to... But it says this in Luke chapter 2. I love this little part. So now it came about in those days that a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that a census be taken of all the inhabited earth. Wow. Now, I would assume that means all the inhabited earth that belonged to Rome, which was a good bit, a large thing. So all the Roman Empire was on the move. They were all on the move to go to do this census so that their taxes could be raised. So I'm sure they're all excited about this. Irritated and aggravated, it's a discomfort, it's going to be more taxes. So the whole empire's on the move just to get two little poor kids from Nazareth to Bethlehem. And you know that to the Jew, a census was sin. Remember when David took a census in the Old Testament? Got in real trouble. Because it's all about pride. And so they were asked to commit a sin against Jewish law, and yet they're on the move. And of course, there's no room in the inn. You've heard me say before, it's not because the innkeeper was a bum. It was because there was no room in the inn. I mean, it did like to have a sign that said, we're Joseph and Mary, we're part of the Christmas story, and we're the most important part. There won't be, now they just were just two poor kids. But they went and stayed in this little cave, lean-to, this stable. And Jesus, the Son of God, was born in a manger, a germ-filled, bacteria-filled place where animals ate. And he was wrapped up in dirty rags as a sign, which we might talk about at some point this afternoon or tomorrow or Sunday. But God used an ungodly man with an ungodly desire to be worshipped, to ask Jews to commit a sin, a census. And the whole earth is on the move to get two people in position where they can do the will of God. You hear what I'm saying to you? How does that work? I don't understand. God, it wasn't like God put it in Pharaoh's heart to do it. I mean, Caesar's heart to do this. But God is so brilliant. He's so extravagantly brilliant. He just weaves his destinies and purposes, his holy things, in the context of evil people, fallen people, doing evil, fallen things. I can't figure that all out. I don't know about it all, but I know it's true. See, one of the biggest things that changed my life was years and years and years ago. See, my father was an alcoholic. He died of a heart attack when I was 19. He had just, on the way home from work, had bought his last half gallon of Early Times whiskey. And then he had a heart attack. Now, my father, gratefully, was not an abusive person. A lot of alcoholics are. But he caused a lot of chaos because he brought a lot of humiliation. He would say, when we had friends come over, he was drunk, he'd say horrible things to them. My brother Jimmy was really the target kid. I remember growing up hearing him scream at each other in the walls. Jimmy and I shared a bedroom, and they would scream at each other. My father would call him a bum. He's never going to be anything in his life. And he would call my father a drunk. You sorry drunk. And, you know, I was 6 years younger than Jimmy, so that was really traumatic. Listen to all this go on. My mom was awesome. I tell this story, and this is true. I've never saw my mom growing up do a selfish thing in relationship to her kids. She was amazing. She was a gift from God because our family was just chaotic. And my father had a printing business and pretty much went broke because he couldn't steward it well, drinking. But what happened to my father is he basically died in World War II. He was in the Philippines. He served as a second lieutenant. They were the ones on the ground telling people to charge. They were the ones that the enemy tried to kill most of the time because they were the most visible. And he really never came home. He came home, but he never really came home. I remember being in the Philippines one time, had this mass grave of Filipinos, but it's like 400,000 graves. Hundreds of thousands of them were Americans. And I thought back then, you know, most people were rural, and they didn't wander very far from their farms or their homes. And I thought, man, how many young kids left and never been 50 miles from home, were halfway around the world, never went home. And I remember crying and weeping about that. And the Lord told me, he said, your dad was buried in the Philippines. He said his body went home, but he never recovered. The only time my father ever had peace is when it would storm and rain really bad. He'd go sit on our porch. He didn't have sod, so he'd get soaking wet. And he would sit there and cry and cry and cry. Because that was the only time that the Japanese soldiers would stop charging. They would do like suicide bonsai attacks. The only time they would stop was be it storming. That was the only time he ever had peace. He had a Japanese flag, and he had names of all these people he knew that had died. And he had died there, and I knew that he had never recovered from that. And I regretted that all my life, that my father was like that. It was an embarrassment. It was created a lot of insecurity and fear. When you're raised with a person with addiction issues, you do a lot of trying to control things because you're anxious, you want some peace, and that kind of stuff. And I was flying in an airplane to Charleston, South Carolina, and I'd become a Christian. I'd been a Christian I'd surrendered my life to Christ for, it had been a couple years, and I was just totally broken, mentally ill, with clinical anxiety and depression. And And I spent a lot of time regretting that I was who I was because I had so much fear in my life. I felt like I was really weak. I didn't like the way I looked. I didn't like my personality. I hated the fact that I was so messed up. Men were supposed to be strong and brave, and I was none of those things. And I blamed it all on the fact that I had such a horrible father. And I used to tell the Lord all the time, God, if you'd just given me a father that would take me to fish or to, you know, make me to hunt or do something. I said, my dad, who I loved, and again, he wasn't abusive, but my dad, he was just an empty shell. The only thing I ever saw him do athletically, he tried to cut the grass one time and did one row, made him sick, and he threw up, and I had to take over. That was my dad. But I'm more like him than any of the kids. I look more like him. I think more like him. He was really brilliant, brilliant guy, and loved to read, but he was just a broken soul. And I remember in that airplane, Joseph's story, and the Lord said, you know, your dad gave you the greatest gift he could have ever given you. If he had been whole, he would have given you what he ended up giving you. I said, what do you mean, Lord? He said, he gave you Jesus. I said, how did he give me Jesus? He said, your weaknesses and all those things in your life that are so broken, your dad played a real role in that being that way. And it crowded you to Christ. It pushed you towards your destiny. And the reality is, if your dad had been wonderful, now did God want my dad to be a godly man? Yeah, of course. But the truth is, I ended up in the arms of Jesus. And maybe if my dad had been perfect, I don't know, maybe I'd have been so adequate I'd have never looked to the Lord. I don't know. I know I can't go back and change it. That's a waste of time. It is what it is. But I do know that God used it. And he said, your dad gave you what he would have given you if you'd have been whole. Jesus. And I thought, wow. And from that day forward, I realized that all the things that happened in my life that are a result of other people's behavior, especially my dad, and others, that God had used it. God had not put that in their lives to do that, but God had used that to push me towards my Egypt so I could fulfill the dreams he had put in my heart, so I could fulfill my destiny in him. And that not only did my dad not keep me from Jesus, he created a desperation in my heart, and blessed are the poor, the desperate, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And I never once again, that was many, many years ago, over 30-something years ago, I've never, ever again, like, cursed my dad or regretted that I had. I wouldn't change anything. You know why? Because the lines have fallen to me in beautiful places, so why would that? I would change them if it could have affected my dad's destiny, but in terms of what happened in my life, I wouldn't change a thing. As a matter of fact, here I am leading an inner healing ministry, an inner healing weekend. And you know why I have always had a passion for this? Because I know what it's like to be broken. And I know what it's like to find in brokenness Jesus being my healer. But I never could have found him as my healer if I hadn't have been broken. And so you know what the Lord did? He identified what I was going to do the rest of my life. And if you know anything about me, this is really my life message. It comes from one direction or another. Telling people that what's happened to you, even some of the choices that you've made that's contributed to it, hasn't disqualified you from everything God has for you. When he, what are we doing? I should look down here. Oh, man. Here's. Thank you, Lord. When the angels told them, the shepherds, he said, the day there's been born for you a Savior goes on. And he said, and this will be a sign for you. You'll find him in a manger wrapped in swaddling cloths. And it was a sign to them. What was the sign? The sign is this. Even if your life is like that, even if your life is, the context of your life is a stable, the manger of your life is dirty, your life has been wrapped up in filthy rags. When Jesus clothes himself in the filthy rags of your life, it's transforming. He's not afraid to be born in a manger. He's not afraid to wrap himself up in the lives of broken people. Matter of fact, he says that we have this treasure in earthen vessels so that the surpassing greatness of the power may be from God, not from ourselves. You mean weaknesses and the brokenness in my life don't disqualify me from the dream, from the destiny? See, now, God may have particular dreams for each of you, but there is one dream that Jesus came and declared for all of us. Jesus said, I came that you might have life and have it more abundantly. Jesus says this in Romans chapter 8. Now listen to the context, because we usually stop with this one verse. And we know that God causes all things to work together for good. He doesn't cause everything. And we know that God causes all things to work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to his purpose, for whom he foreknew. Keep going. For those who he already loved before him. He loved you before the foundation of the world. He also predestined. You have a predestiny. God has a dream for each one of you. He predestined to be conformed to the image of his Son. That you might be the firstborn among many brethren, Jesus. That'd be a whole bunch of people, a race of people that would look just like him. That would live just like him. And he goes on and says, and he makes it happen by placing him in us. By imparting his life into us. That's his dream. Your dream is to be Christ-like. And all the things that happen in your life that would seem to keep that dream from ever happening, decisions that you made, decisions that other people made concerning you, painful, dysfunctional, cruel, evil. Again, remember the brothers having a meal while their brother is crying out, pleading for them to rescue him, to take him out of the pit, and they just slowly had a nice meal. The evil involved in all that. And yet God used it all. He didn't cause it all. He used it all. The Midianites provided transportation to get him there. And all those things that looked like setbacks in his life, what was the dream? He was going to govern. He was going to rule. He learned how to do that in Potiphar's house. He learned how to do that in the jail. The favor of the Lord was with him. The presence of God was with him, even in the setbacks. And God used the setbacks to prepare him to fulfill the dream. He learned to manage everything Potiphar had. He learned to manage everything in the jail. Those things in your life that seem to be setbacks, they're only permanent if your attitude owns that. If you give in to bitterness and resentment and anger. But if you'll notice, when he's in Potiphar's house, it says the Lord was with him. And the Lord gave him favor and prospered him. When he's in jail, the Lord was with him. And the Lord gave him favor and prospered him. There's no sign of bitterness. At some point, somehow, when he didn't get delivered, he clicked over and believed, Lord, I don't know how this is happening. I don't know why this is happening. And I don't know all the details, but I do know you're faithful. And you're going to use it all to fulfill your predestined dream in my life. I may not have done it all right, Lord. Others didn't. Because there's no sign of bitterness. As a matter of fact, and then we'll finish. This won't take about 5 more minutes, but I didn't want to stop it. When they finally meet him, it's a cool story. There's fun stuff. They meet him. He plays games with them. But this is 13 years later. He's now 30 years old. And they meet him because they're there to get food. They're desperate. Jacob had sent them to go get food. And he's the guy in charge. And they don't recognize him. Several stories of him going off into a room and weeping. Just amazing. This is what it says here. This is chapter 42. They don't know who he is yet. Now Joseph was the ruler of over the land. He was one who sold to all the people of the land. And Joseph's brothers came and bowed down to him with their faces to the ground. When Joseph saw his brothers, he recognized them but disguised himself. Verse 29, and Joseph remembered the dreams which he had had about them bowing down before him. 13 years later or more, maybe 15 years later or so, he sees them and they bow down before him just like the dream had been. And I love this. This is chapter 44. Chapter 45. He finally reveals himself to them. and says, I'm Joseph, your brother. When they realize who he is, he comes closer, and they come closer, and they said, I'm your brother Joseph, whom you sold to Egypt. He's not denying that they did what they did. But listen to what he says. No bitterness. Listen to his attitude. But do not be grieved or angry with yourselves. They sold him into slavery. Wanted to kill him. I would have rather been dead than be sold into slavery. Do not be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life. For the famine has been in the land these 2 years, and there are still 5 years in which there will neither be plowing nor harvesting. And God sent me here. What? God sent me here. Huh? Didn't they send him there by selling him to slavery? Didn't the say the Midianites brought him to Egypt? He says, but God sent me here before you to preserve for you a remnant in the earth and to keep you alive by great deliverance. Now therefore, hear these words, crazy words, crazy words. Christian life is a life of faith. Faith is a crazy thing sometimes. Therefore, it was not you who sent me here, but God. And he has made me a father to Pharaoh and the Lord of all his household and ruler over all the land of Egypt. Hurry now, go up to my father, say to him, thus says your son Joseph, God has made me Lord of all of Egypt, and you shall live in the land of Goshen. And he said, you're going to have the best you can have. You give him everything. You got Pharaoh involved. He blessed him. Here, do you understand the faith thing? Because look in chapter 40, chapter 50. In chapter 50, after Jacob dies, the father dies, the brothers get scared again. Okay, now that dad's dead, I bet Joseph's going to take out his vengeance on us. But they couldn't believe that he could actually be that kind. And his brothers come and they fall down before him and said, behold, we are your servants. But Joseph said to them, do not be afraid. Am I in God's place? What you did is between you and God. He said, as for you, you meant it for evil. I understand that. You really did. But God meant it for good in order to bring about this present result to preserve many people alive. If I hadn't gotten here, I couldn't interpret the dream. I wouldn't have given the idea of storing up all the grain. How many people in the world would have died if I hadn't come here? You in particular. I came here to preserve your life. Joseph wasn't concerned about getting even, didn't want them to suffer, didn't want to pay. Well, I want to pay. They need to pay. Look what they did to me. They robbed me. They stole my life from me. Nobody has the ability to steal your life from you. God has a predestiny for you to be conformed to the image of Jesus. That's life and life more abundant. The life that Jesus lives is the coolest, most incredible, wonderful life a human being can live. Nobody can take that from you. But you. They may hurt you. They may have devastated you. But only your unforgiveness is the thief. And Joseph said, you meant it for evil. There was no bitterness. There was no revenge. There was no getting even. He just loved them. And so let me just tell you something. You meant it for evil. That's between you and God. But everything you did to me, God used to propel me forward into his purposes. They didn't stop him. They ushered him in. They were a shortcut to getting him in position to be all that God had called him to be. If that were true, if Joseph believed, even in your evil, God sent me here. God meant it for good. I'm not in God's place. That's between you and God. God will do what he's going to do with you. I just know that God's bigger than you. And I know that my destiny can't be taken from me because of your behavior, because of the evil in this fallen world. And as a matter of fact, I don't only want you to be, I said, I don't want you to be angry at yourself. I just want to bless you. And he comforted them. It wasn't like, we stole 13 years of your life. We want to comfort you. No, he comforted them because he understood that nobody can steal It's the enemy who kills, steals, and destroys, but Jesus came to have life and life and more abundantly. And the things and the circumstances of life, the Lord doesn't do them, but he uses them. If what I just told you is true, then it frees me up to forgive. Because ultimately, you didn't cost me anything. I forgive you and I bless you. Because you were meaning to destroy me. And it almost did. And then one day I woke up and I realized my destiny was in God's hands, not yours. So I forgive you. And I love you. And I don't want you to walk around hating yourself now that you get it. I forgive you. Let me bless you. By my stripes, let me heal you. That's who Jesus is. By my stripes. We striped him. Jesus said, by my stripes you're healed. And those people who stripe us, may they be healed because of the way we respond in forgiveness and mercy. Amen?
Amen.
In the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Alrighty. It's 10:53. We'll start back up at 11 o'clock.